All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We'll go ahead and get started. My name is Justin Logan. I'm the director of the Defense and Foreign Policy Studies program here at Cato. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to our event looking at Taiwan's need for asymmetric defense capabilities. My colleague Eric Gomez wrote a paper roughly by that title, Taiwan's Urgent Need for Asymmetric Defense. And we're here to talk about the themes in the paper and the theme more generally. And I hope you'll bear with us today as we pivot to Asia, as it were, away from the commanding heights of the magical floating pier and the territorial settlement that will hopefully emerge at some point in the four eastern oblasts of Ukraine, to pivot to a competition between the United States and China, which has roughly 80% the GDP that the United States does, larger relative to the United States than the Soviet Union ever was, and an increasingly forward-leaning and aggressive policy vis-a-vis Taiwan, rather. And so there's a lot that is focused on in the United States about the U.S.-China balance, but somewhat less of somewhat less note is the China-Taiwan balance. And the fact that I think you'll hear Eric talk about is that in the opening hours and days of a potential conflict between China and Taiwan, there are certain things that Taiwan could only do on its own unless the United States were to station, I don't know, tens of thousands of Marines conceivably on Taiwan, which would be its own leap into the dark. So it's quite important, Taiwan's capabilities. This isn't just a U.S.-China competition with Taiwan at the center. Taiwan has a role to play that is not optional, and I think you'll hear some criticism and some concern about Taiwan's efforts to that score. So what I'll do is introduce the three panelists at the outset, then I'll be quiet. Eric and Mike are both going to give PowerPoint presentations, which makes me white-knuckle freak out. Hopefully it will all go well. This is a good time to thank the tech folks and the conference folks for making these events happen. So first will be Eric Gomez, who's my colleague. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Defense and Foreign Policy Studies. He co-edited the book America's Nuclear Crossroads, a forward-looking anthology. So Eric has interest in both the nuclear question and in particular on Asian security issues. He received his BA in International Relations from the State of New York College at Geneseo and an MA from the Bush School at Texas A&M. Michael Hunziker is the second speaker. He's associate professor at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, associate director of the Schar School Center for Security Policy Studies, and a senior non-resident fellow at CSBA. He's co-authored pieces and authored pieces relating to conventional deterrence in northeastern Europe as well as in the Taiwan Strait. He's the author of the book Dying to Learn, Wartime Lessons from the Western Front, which was focused, as you might have guessed, on wartime learning. Important. He served in the U.S. Marine Corps from 2000 to 2006 and received an AB from UC Berkeley and a PhD, MPA, and AM from Princeton University. And the final speaker this afternoon is Alex Velez-Green, who's a senior policy advisor at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for National Security. He served as a defense strategy and policy analyst at Systems Planning and Analysis Incorporated and held multiple roles at the Center for New American Security. Previously, he served as national security advisor to U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, and his research focuses on defense, deterrence, and alliance management in the Indo-Pacific in particular, in addition to Europe and the Middle East. He graduated cum laude with a bachelor's degree from Harvard University. So with all my shaky anticipation for this PowerPoint situation, Eric, take us away and set the table for us, you will.
Thank you very much. If I could get my slides on the screen. So hi, everyone. I'm Eric Gomez. I'm the author of Taiwan's Urgent Need for Asymmetric Defense right here. You can get physical copies if you're in the audience today outside on your way in or out. And if you're online, I'm sure there's a link there. And so as Justin said, and this is the sort of general rundown of my presentation and also a major points of what's in the paper, I wanted to look at, you know, what does Taiwan need to do really well to get its self-defense right? And so today we're going to talk about, you know, what does that mean? Where are their self-defense shortcomings currently? And then the sort of guiding military idea that I had for improving their self-defense, which is looking at these two decisive military operations and figuring out what asymmetric capabilities can best do to contribute to Taiwan's success in those operations. Finally, look at some policy recommendations of what the U.S. can do to help Taiwan with this transformation. Getting Taiwan's self-defense right is sort of a no-brainer, no matter what grand strategy you adhere to, right? So I've been at the Cato Institute for a very long time. I'm a big fan of restraint. I don't want the United States to fight a war against China for the sake of Taiwan. And what I am recommending here is something that I hope will provide a bit of an out for the United States, to provide a means for Taiwan to defend itself that both strengthens deterrence but also puts them in a better warfighting posture. But if you're a primacist, right, a stronger Taiwan is also a good idea, because even if you believe the U.S. should intervene, then having a stronger Taiwan makes sense for you as well. It's something that is, it's just a good idea no matter kind of what perspective you come at it from. It's also important because, as Justin alluded to, even if the U.S. intervenes very quickly, we're going to be doing different things in different parts of the region than Taiwan for at least some appreciable period of time. I don't know how long that period of time might be if the U.S. were to intervene, but it would probably be on the order of at least days, if not weeks. So Taiwan needs to have enough of a self-defense posture to do well in those early days when it's going to be alone, even if we intervene fairly fast. And finally, I think especially in the realm of air and sea combat, the Ukraine war is showing how asymmetric defense can really, really work well for a country that's on the defense, right? And there's two images, right? The upper one is an unmanned drone boat that the Ukrainians have been using to really good effect to keep the Russian Black Sea Fleet bottled up, if not, you know, slowly sinking it piece by piece when Ukraine doesn't have a navy anymore. And the bottom picture is a Russian helicopter being shot down by a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile. Not everything about Ukraine is about asymmetric defense, but in the key areas of air and sea denial, which is something that Taiwan really should be getting good at, it's working very well. So Taiwan has been adopting this kind of, you know, if you're a fan of the show Chernobyl, right, the not great, not terrible approach. In a lot of respects, they've been taking some positive steps towards adopting asymmetric defense. I'm going to say asymmetric defense a lot. Mike has a great slide explaining what this means, so wait for him to explain it. It's too much, and I'm too long-winded to do it in mine. But Taiwan has been increasing defense spending, but slowly. Taiwan has been adopting more asymmetric capabilities, but also hedging and deciding, hey, maybe we should have large surface warships that are really expensive and take up a lot of yard time to build. They're also extending conscription back up to a year from 4 months, which I would argue is a good thing for the personnel and training issues that they have, but they still have a lot of other issues to work out, and Mike will go into detail on some of those. And this is just a chart to explain the defense spending piece. As you can see here, it's going up, right? This is good. But you can see, if you look at it over the 30-year timeline, it's still well below where it used to be in the 90s, right? So Taiwan still has a long way to go to get itself to a place where this is somewhat sustainable. How should they think about the problem? I argue that they should focus on two military operations: surviving a conventional bombardment and preventing an amphibious lodgment on the island. Why these two operations? Well, looking at Chinese military doctrine and how they sort of think about and exercise conducting an invasion of Taiwan, these are both likely to occur relatively early in the conflict, when Taiwan is at its highest likelihood of fighting by itself. Number two, the Taiwanese military in its current form is very poorly situated to dealing with these scenarios, and so they have the most work to do to get to a place where they're sort of minimally able to prevail, or at least not lose quickly. And finally, the results of these operations could be decisive for the entire effort, right? This is a situation where if Taiwan does poorly in these two things and they lose fast, then even the prospect of a very large American intervention starts looking dubious in terms of fixing the situation, right? Because then you're looking at a situation where we have to do a lot to not only resist China, but also to reverse gains, right? And when you start getting into that, you're talking about a much wider aperture of military stuff we have to throw at China to win, That could, you know, veer into the nuclear escalation world. It's not a pretty picture. But if Taiwan does these two things well, if they either lose slowly or do better than expected and sort of keep Chinese ground forces off the island, then things start looking a lot better for them, both in terms of a warfighting perspective and the pre-war deterrence prevention of conflict perspective. So, conventional bombardment, the Chinese call this a joint firepower strike campaign. This is large-scale missile attacks on mostly coming from Chinese ground-based missiles, but also aircraft, drones, ships, etc., targeting stationary, what, you know, sort of called enabling capabilities, right? The things that allow you to do other military stuff. So air bases, naval bases, power facilities, roads, transportation hubs, command and control hubs, stuff you can't move, right? Stuff that's stationary. How does asymmetric defense help this? Well, asymmetric systems tend to be more mobile than their traditional, what I call in the paper, traditional counterparts. I think that's a term that the Taiwanese themselves use, asymmetric and traditional. By traditional systems, I mean, you know, manned fighter aircraft, large surface warships, that kind of thing. Because asymmetric systems tend to have more mobility, you can distribute them. You can spread them out more. You can make them less vulnerable to sort of decapitation attack and the targeting of fixed infrastructure. Because they tend to have smaller logistics footprints, it means you can operate them even if your larger logistics hubs get taken out. Maybe not as effectively as before, but you're not sort of out of the fight if you lose major logistics facilities early. And finally, doing decentralized command and control. I have a paragraph where I talk about the Marine Corps, and Mike. Maybe not anymore. Force Design 2030, the Marine Corps plan to sort of make themselves better for a China fight. One of the aspects of that that's really important is they're getting strike and reconnaissance systems into the hands of lower level commanders, right? I think platoon or company level, as opposed to higher up at like the regimental or brigade level. And what this does is, if the regimental or brigade people get taken out, or if that command and control link is disrupted from an attack, the lower level guys can still operate somewhat effectively on the battlefield. They have more options at lower levels of command. The second piece of preventing an amphibious lodgment, this is really about defeating the purpose-built Chinese amphibious forces that are going to constitute the initial waves of ground troops landing on Taiwan. The good news for Taiwan here is that this is a very difficult military operation to do, and China has surprisingly not as much resources to do this. there's a great line from a National Defense University study on this from a couple years ago that says, you know, significant shortages or not a lot of blank space in the Chinese amphibious assault ships means that even the loss of a handful could prove disastrous to the entire endeavor. Yes, they might complement this using civilian shipping. We can get into that in Q&A if you want. I don't think that is going to be a very effective way to do things, especially if Taiwan has any kind of resistance operating on the island. Those ships are very large. They're very easy to target. Yes, Taiwan needs a lot more munitions to target them, but that's a relatively easy problem to solve. I think this is mostly going to be the amphibious purpose-built units of the PLA trying to establish this. And this is important because if you can prevent them from establishing it, I've been involved in a couple of war games about this, and one of the things that keeps coming up is, man, it's hard to keep this force alive, right? You really need to establish a nice foothold and then build out from it if the Chinese want to have a chance of success at the invasion. Asymmetric defense capabilities help you get there in a better way. Those are the sort of the two operations. To move on to policy recommendations while we're still sort of in time, I have five in the piece. Three on security assistance, two on assurances to China. On the security assistance side, I argue that the U.S. going forward should only sell Taiwan asymmetric capabilities and munitions for them. There's a $19 billion arms sales backlog. I've done a lot of work on the arms sale backlog. I have charts galore in backup if you really want to get into that, I'm happy to. A lot of that is like F-16s make up $8 billion of that. I think we should sell them because they're only a few years away from delivery. It doesn't make sense to kind of cancel them now because stuff is already being built. But going forward, stop selling them the stuff that is going to be taken out very easily by China. TERRA, the Taiwan Enhanced Resiliency Act, passed a couple years ago as part of the NDAA process, has a great list of what they call counter-intervention capabilities. Almost a perfect list that I, again, get into in more detail in the paper. We should sell them that stuff and not stuff that isn't on that list. I think that there should be a moderate expansion of U.S. training of Taiwanese troops, although and this we talked before about where will we find areas to disagree. This is one area where I disagree with Mike. Mike has written before about the need for sort of larger rotational training deployments between Taiwan and the United States. I don't think that's a good idea, in part because of potential political implications across the strait, but also because I don't think that's what the Taiwanese really need to be good at. They don't really need to be good at interoperability with the U.S. military to do these operations well. We're going to be fighting in different areas and doing different things anyway, and so I think it's less important. And then the final point is improving Taiwan's defense industrial base. We're seeing the U.S. DIB get stressed a lot by the Ukraine war and the need to produce a lot of those munitions. Asymmetric warfare uses a lot of cheaper per unit stuff, but you still need large quantities of it, right? You're going to be using a lot of drones. You're going to be using a lot of mines, missiles, et cetera. You need to stockpile a lot of munitions. One way we can help do that is through things like co-production, to say, listen, we have a weapon that the U.S. has designed, but if a Taiwanese company can build it in Taiwan instead of us building it in the United States, then let them do that. It gives their defense industry some practice, and it allows them to clear backlogs of things faster. The final point is assurances towards China. And this is something that often gets ignored in discussions about Taiwan and the United States. Mostly it's about how can we deter. Assurance is the other side of the deterrence coin, right? It's the idea of signaling aspects of restraint to show China, if you don't do the things we don't want you to do, then we will also do things that, you know, are somewhat favorable to you to kind of induce positive behavior. Taiwan needs time to do all this. I think all of the stuff I described here is doable and can work, but it's going to take time. It's not a switch we can flip and everything gets better overnight. And assurances are about buying that time, right? It's primarily about allowing us to behave or do things in the Taiwan Strait that kind of don't purposefully, you know, take the delicate structure of cross-strait stability and like shake it apart, right? And
the
yes,
Pelosi
I know.
Pelosi visit. You're talking about the Pelosi visit.
Yes, I'm talking about the Pelosi visit. So the two things, specific things and a general thing. The specific thing, I think the U.S. should be willing to limit weapon sales to Taiwan on this axis of only asymmetric systems in the future. We've never before been willing to sort of offer China an assurance that, hey, listen, we're only going to sell X but not Y. I think it's in our interest to tell them that. I think it makes sense for Taiwan's self-defense. It also has some interesting implications for like legal and funding mechanisms to get weapons to Taiwan faster. We can go into that in greater detail if you want. Finally, this no symbolism, all substance. That's the Pelosi visit. Right, we're fond of doing big symbolic things that say, hey, Taiwan, we're with you, we're with you, we're with you, that have almost no material impact on improving Taiwan's security. The Pelosi visit in August 2022 and Tsai's visit with McCarthy in 2023 are two great examples of this. China used both to justify much higher day-to-day military activity around Taiwan, and neither of them produced anything in the way of legislation, arms sales, you know, anything material to improve Taiwan's condition. We should stop that stuff. This is just sort of like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly, carry a big stick. We've been doing the opposite. We've been speaking loudly while the stick has languished. We should return to speaking softly and getting the stick in a better spot. With that, I am done. And I'm looking forward to your questions, and I hope you'll read. I hope this provides fodder for you to read the entire thing. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric. Mike, take us away. Oh, you got
oh,
a
right. Oh, yeah. You have
gotta
a
get my.
This is all very fancy.
Now, do I need to advance this slide?
Big green button.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Awesome. So, well, Justin, first off, thanks so much for having me. And can I say, this is I haven't been here since before the pandemic. This is impressive. Eric, first of all, thank you for referring to me as a Marine, because my students think of me as being older than time, so anything that makes me feel still young is good. More important, congratulations on the project. I think it is a really important contribution that really helps us gain some granularity into the challenges we face, so that we aren't just talking mystically and we're making practical progress. And Alex, it's great to see you, as always. Now, when Eric invited me to come and participate in this panel, I thought to myself, what makes for a good panel? And it quickly dawned on me, interesting panels are one in which the panelists are arguing with each other. And I was like, that's going to be a problem here, because it's going to be very difficult. I'm sure Justin's going to try, but to find a whole heck of a lot of daylight between us, I'm sure we could split some hairs here, and I'll try to find some of these. So in order to foster maybe a more interesting dialogue back and forth, I'm not going to argue with Eric, because I think all three of us are more or less in violent agreement, but rather to focus on a slightly different part of the challenge or the problem set, especially as it pertains to the thing we all care about, which is moving the needle on getting Taiwan to embrace asymmetry. So here's my bottom line up front. Eric and his project are important, and he's right. We need to do a better job of getting Taiwan the asymmetric weapons and the asymmetric munitions that it needs. But weapons and bullets and missiles are necessary. They are not sufficient. They are only a part of the problem and the solution, and arguably they're the easier part of the solution. I'm not saying fixing the defense industrial base is easy. Right. But I think if we want to get Taiwan's military from where it is right now to where at least those of us sitting on the stage would like it to be, really that's going to take wholesale transformation. So to get Taiwan and Taiwan's military to embrace asymmetry, I think that requires doctrinal change, change in how it fights, institutional change, change in all the kind of nitinoid bureaucratic details behind the scenes. And I think it takes societal change. And the more I think about it, and I've been talking to a lot of colleagues back in Taiwan, and they're really convincing me, I think societal change actually has to come first, and this is the real challenge. You think a defense industrial base is hard to change, imagine social change. But everything else, the institution and the doctrine and the willingness to fight, that is all downstream of society. So a couple of preliminaries before I dive into the essence of my argument. The first thing is, it's very common in Washington, because we like technological solutions, we like to silo and stovepipe, to think of asymmetry as a military problem. But I would submit to you that asymmetry, and indeed any realistic defense posture, even if Taiwan just decides to go a different way, it is not a military problem, it's a Taiwan problem. And you only have to look at a very simple map of the distribution of the population in Taiwan to see that there is no, if you take the risk of invasion seriously, which I think we should, there is no realistic way to invade Taiwan in a way such that the Taiwanese military or the government can separate the battle space from the people. So to fight asymmetrically in the asymmetric battle space means the people have to be a part of this solution. Which takes me to the second preliminary in the piece that Eric promised I would do. Definitions. And I'm sorry, I'm a professor, so I guess I'm not sorry, but definitions matter, and I hate to be pedantic to an audience. You probably wouldn't be here if you didn't have a good sense of what asymmetry is. But the fact of the matter is, and I've been working this issue, so as a Marine, I trained Taiwanese Marines back in the early 2000s. I've been back to Taiwan every year for 20 years, except for a couple of years in the pandemic. And I will tell you, there is a common refrain that one of the reasons Taiwan can't wholeheartedly embrace asymmetry the way America's pushing them is we just don't see eye to eye on what asymmetry is. We define it in a different way. Now, I'm going to call shenanigans. I'm very skeptical of that view, but even if we admit to it, then it means we just need to be very clear about what we're looking for with asymmetry. So to spell it out, when I am talking about asymmetry, I think when Eric is talking about asymmetry, we're referring to large numbers of cheap, and this is the key, cheap, because it's all about opportunity costs. 8 diesel submarines for a total of $16+ billion might be asymmetric militarily, but it's not asymmetric in terms of the amount of the defense budget, which more or less is equivalent to 1 year of total Taiwanese defense spending. Large numbers of cheap, mobile, and highly lethal platforms that are used by well-trained units as part of a holistic, decentralized, empowering to the lower levels, because the Chinese are going to do the best they can to cut the head off the snake, as part of a multi-layered defense in depth that at the end of the day is reinforced and buttressed by a territorial defense force, which is to say the Taiwanese people themselves, some of them fighting and the rest of them willing to carry on the struggle for as long as is necessary. So this is what worries me. This is what keeps me up at night, and I don't even mean figuratively, I mean quite literally. I'm not worried because I think Taiwan's military isn't embracing asymmetry. I'm worried because I don't think Taiwan's military is ready for war. full stop. Taiwan's military is optimized for a slow mobilization, quick and fast fight. And I think anyone who seriously looks at Chinese options says, well, the real problem might be rapid mobilization and a fight that takes a lot longer than anyone's prepared for. So let me go through a litany, and at some point you're going to just have to cut me off because I can go and go and go and go on this one. But a litany of the challenges that suggest to me that Taiwan is not yet serious, and I put the responsibility here, let me be blunt, on the senior political leadership and the senior military leadership. I think societal change starts at the top. Let me talk about a few of the challenges. Number one, their training is perfunctory. Talk to anyone. Lots of people go to Taiwan and they talk to the administration, they talk to senior military officers, they talk to National Security Council. I can tell you, spoiler alert, what they're going to say. They're going to say everything is good. We're making the changes that need to happen. Go and talk to the majors and the colonels and the lieutenants and the privates who are actually out there. And they will tell you, 20 years on, because I saw the same thing when I was in Kaohsiung training Marines in 2004. It's all about form. It is not about substance. Recruits and trainees spend more time drilling, literally marching around, inspections, polishing, and making their beds. They're very serious about how they make their racks. Mowing the lawn, standing guard duty, or listening to lecture than they are about actually getting out into the field and training. Take a look at those pictures. I mean, that is emblematic of the difference between an American war game and a Taiwanese war game. When they do go to the field, the exercises are scripted. And so you read about the news about the Hong Kong exercise, yada, yada. They're all scripted exercises in which the outcome is well known and everybody knows the role that they're supposed to play. Second, there are tremendous shortages across the force, and conscription will begin to solve the problems, but begin to solve the problem. If we take the Davidson window seriously, there's not enough time to close that gap. Where are the shortages? Well, combat units. Even with conscription, Taiwanese, for reasons I'll get to in a moment, don't want to be in combat units. So many combat units still are at about 60% of their authorized end strength. There are shortages in NCOs, not just people wearing the rank of NCO, but literally NCOs as we would understand non-commissioned officers. These career-oriented enlisted personnel who have been trained and empowered to make decisions. That doesn't exist in the Taiwanese model. They are NCOs, they're corporals and sergeants, but they don't act the way that we would need them to act if we want to have a decentralized way of fighting. There aren't enough junior officers. So here's a mind-blowing concept for you. For us, the U.S. Military Academy, West Point, Annapolis, they are elite, prestigious places to go. You have to whack people away with a bat, and the acceptance rate is really low. Taiwan hasn't been able to fill all the seats at its military academies or any of its other three pipelines to get into a commission. As a result, it has to lower its standards, both mentally and physically, and you can only imagine the selection effects of that. There are also shortages in terms of munitions and in terms of parts. Go to IIS's Military Balance Report, and you'd be blown away by how many armored vehicles Taiwan has. But it looks like about half of them are probably operational at any given point in time. You want all the work, that's not going to happen. Same goes for its air platforms. About half of them probably operational at any given time, and that's actually getting worse because they keep insisting on flying intercept missions into the gray zone, which is smoking their pilots and smoking their aircraft. About the only thing Taiwan doesn't have a shortage in are generals. So here's a number for you. Taiwan's got, I'm rounding here, about 188,000, a little less than that, people in uniform. They have 300 general and flag officers. That's a ratio for comparison. The U.S. military active duty has 800 generals and flag officers for 1.3 million active duty forces. That ratio for Taiwan is about double what the U.S. model has. And talk to some U.S. officers and enlisted personnel. They'll say there are already too many generals and flag officers. In fact, Taiwan has the same number of generals and flag officers as it had when it was nearly three times the size a couple decades ago. Which leads to the next problem. It is a highly, highly, highly centralized organization. And for those of you who know the military, all militaries are centralized, certainly more so than, you know, think tanks or things. but this is like order of magnitude different. So I have seen with my own two eyes presentations where colonels are running the PowerPoint. They're moving the projector. That's a job we would hand to a private in the U.S. military. It is well known you do not pass bad news up the chain of command, hence the fact that the exercises are good. There is no real red team, because a red team might embarrass the good team by pantsing the general in front of his or her troops. Which leads to the next problem. This all starts at the top. There is insufficient civilian oversight. Now, it has become a truism, if you've been following this debate, that the Ministry of National Defense lacks an equivalent to the Office of the Secretary of Defense where we can manage oversight with civilian leadership. Yes, that is true. It'd be great if they passed a law and created that. That in itself wouldn't solve the problem because neither party, the DPP or the KMT, has a sufficient bench of civilian experts who know what they're doing and have an interest and an ability to go there and enforce change if the political leadership were to declare it necessary. And those who are civilian ministers of defense, they're typically actually just retired generals. put all this together and you can start to get the sense that morale in the military is low. I mean, again, it's a truism. If people aren't complaining, they're not happy, but it's way worse than that in Taiwan's military. Yes, it's kind of an East Asian cultural attribute that military service is not held as being a prestigious thing to do. It's worse in Taiwan because Taiwan has this legacy of authoritarian rule, and the military by many is still seen as this tool of authoritarian repression. But even among younger Taiwanese who have no living memory of what life under authoritarian rule was like, for them, military service equals waste of time. Waste of time because they don't think the military is going to work, because we might lie to ourselves in Washington about what Taiwan's military is capable of, but they know their friends are serving. And on top of that, it doesn't pay well. And if you know anything about Taiwan, you know anything about Taipei, it's a really expensive place to live, so they're worried about getting enough rent to pay the bills. So I'm sure we're all familiar with the Reaganism, truism, trust but verify. I don't think that's going to work here. My suggestion is I think we shouldn't trust. I think we should do a lot of verification. I will be clear. I think the Ministry of National Defense knows what we're talking about. Any mistranslation, I think, has long ago been disabused, but they're still dragging their feet. I think senior political leaders in the KMT and the DPP know what we are after. But the MND doesn't want it. And let's be honest, I'm going to say the people don't care. That's not what I mean in the pejorative sense. They have other things that are more pressing concerns. The threat perception from Taipei is not the threat perception. It's not what you read in the media. I spend a lot of time there. The Taiwanese people are not freaking out about aid intrusions and balloons flying over their island the way that we're freaking out. The threat perception is different. Therefore, they're worried about dinner table type issues. Am I going to have enough money to ever be able to afford an apartment? Just to tell you, the average Taiwanese person spending their entire income for 20 years will barely be able to pay for the average apartment in Taiwan. That's what worries them. Therefore, the political cost of forcing change onto the military just isn't worth it for Taiwanese political leaders, given that the population just isn't all that interested, but it's also not that interested because the political leadership doesn't want to make it look like they're the ones who have mismanaged the cross-strait relationship. Therefore, the solution has been, yeah, America wants asymmetry, like Erica said, so we'll get half measures, we'll get lip service, they'll flap their arms and do just enough to make it look like they're taking this seriously, and then let business go on as usual. So what can we do? A few thoughts. Yes, we need to provide resources. Yes, we need to get all the weapons, asymmetric weapons, that we can. And this is where I guess we would disagree. I think full court press, mobile training teams are good. Even better is to rotate units back here where you can get them out of their comfort zone, get them away from some of their senior leadership and try to kind of literally re-socialize them. Anything we can do to include training also mid-officers to teach them just these new ways of fighting and operating so when they become generals, they can institute. I think we provide resources also in terms of money, but all these resources cannot be a blank check. Strings must be attached. They must be attached because they're in our interest. I think they also should be attached because some of this is just the cold-hearted political calculus of is the juice worth the squeeze for me as an elected leader. We have to make that juice worth the squeeze, and we can help President Lai as he comes into office by tying his hands and saying, if you want these things and American support, you got to do these things for us. Yes, it's going to be painful. Yes, it's going to be costly. You got 4 years, so best to start with that right now. I think we also have to be honest. And I've written quite a few articles, and I've taken quite a bit of heat by people saying, why would you say these things about our partner? That undermines deterrence. Newsflash. If we know about it, Beijing knows about it. We are not saying anything that they are not acutely aware of, because most of these units probably have a few people whose alliances are questionable. In my estimation, I have a good friend in Taiwan named Tom, and he likes to remind us that sunlight is the best disinfectant. If we sweep things under the rug, we won't know that we need to fix them. So let's be honest, it is the one huge comparative advantage that we have as liberal democracies. Let's talk about it, and then let's be serious about fixing it, which is the last point. I think we do have to have some amount of modesty, both in how long this is going to take, but in really looking at ourselves and saying, are we the right people? Yes, I think we need more trainers, but are we the best model? As an Iraq veteran, I have lived experience trying to reform another military to look like ours. It didn't work well. I also don't think it's going to work great in Taiwan. We may not be the best model, maybe Israel, maybe Estonia, or, and this might sound blasphemous, maybe we should approach Taiwan as its own unique entity, that we should treat it as such, recognize its problems. It might have some similarities, but maybe they also have some differences, and tailor our answers for what Taiwan really needs and Taiwan really wants. So with that, I hand it over to you, Alex.
All righty.
Thank you, Mike.
I'll start by thanking Cato and Eric and Justin very much for the invitation. It's great to be on the panel with everybody else. I've recently come to the conclusion I should have had a PowerPoint too. Those are both very cool. And the technically seems to be working well. So I missed opportunity for me, but regardless, bear with me. I'm going to talk a bit more about sort of the congressional angle here, thinking about the military context, and also kind of where things stand today. Before I start, I'd like to make clear that my remarks, they reflect my views, not necessarily the position of the Heritage Foundation or anybody else. So for context, when I arrived in the U.S. Senate in 2019, Taiwan wasn't really on Congress's radar, certainly not from a defense perspective. I keenly recall Senator Hawley at the time as my boss, what was typically the only member on the Senate Armed Services Committee even asking about Taiwan during hearings, and that was typical for the first couple of years there. This all began to change. Mike mentioned the Davidson window. He's referencing what was started in March 2021, which is an Admiral Phil Davidson, then the commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, came before the Senate Armed Services Committee to testify. And if you recall, he was asked for his views on when Xi Jinping might invade Taiwan. He responded, and this is a quote, "I think the threat is manifest during this decade, in fact, in the next 6 years." So that's by 2027. I would say that this is when Congress started to pay attention to the Taiwan problem. Over the next several months, I was involved in an effort to try and better understand what exactly Admiral Davidson was talking about and what we could do about it. As that work unfolded, it became clear to me that we had a very serious problem. The U.S.-China military balance had eroded far more severely and in some ways more rapidly than was widely understood, and trends were still unfavorable. China was still, and this is still true today in key areas, getting stronger relative to the United States. So, you know, in practical terms, it means, you know, as a general matter, deterrence is weakening, war is becoming more likely, and it also became evident to me for the first time, again, this is back in 2021, that if deterrence fails, the United States may not be able to win a war over Taiwan. And as I spoke to more folks around town at that time, again in the years since, it became evident I wasn't the only one with those concerns. So the question then came again, sort of, what can we do about it? And thinking not just about the 2030s, which is, you know, what a lot of folks in defense planning and policymaking talk about, right? But no, what can we do to strengthen deterrence now, as quickly as possible in this decade, ideally before 2027? And as we did that analysis, and, you know, talking to folks like Mike, talking to folks in the Department of Defense, State, intelligence community, in the White House, going again out to the region, talking to the Taiwanese themselves, one of the key insights we came to was that one of the most important things we can do, in some ways the most important thing we can do, was to help Taiwan get to a point where it would be able to defend itself effectively. And the reason for this, you know, there's multiple reasons, but from a military perspective, Eric spoke to this as well. The best way to deter China from invading Taiwan is through what's called a denial defense, which is by posturing forces to convince Xi Jinping and his lieutenants not just that an invasion of Taiwan would be terribly costly, but that it would fail. But for a denial defense to work, you've got to position combat-credible forces forward. In other words, you've got to present such a strong forward defense that an adversary like Xi Jinping, looking at the battle space, has to come to the conclusion that he will be unable to achieve a fait accompli like the Russians achieved in Crimea in 2014, that he won't be able to move fast and hard and achieve victory before we're able to react effectively. In the case of Taiwan, nobody, self-evident, nobody is farther forward than Taiwan itself. And so as Eric writes in this paper, especially in the initial period of war when China is doing everything it can to keep U.S. forces far from the island, Taiwanese forces are going to have to do a lot of the heavy lifting to hold off that invasion force. So if we're going to defeat a Chinese invasion, or ideally deterred in the first place, Taiwan has to be ready. The next commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Sam Papara, he was just up for his confirmation hearing in the Senate recently. He testified this when he said that actions, and again, this is a quote, "actions that Taiwan takes to strengthen its own defenses have a 3-to-1 leverage against aggression." I will say, though, and this is consistent, again, with what you've already heard, Taiwan doesn't need just any weapons. They need to field the asymmetric defense capabilities that Eric was referencing. These are, and Mike as well, large numbers of relatively cheap and mobile anti-ship missiles, naval mines, air and missile defenses, long-range fires, anti-armor weapons, and, again, other capabilities that allow Taiwanese defenders to delay, degrade, and destroy Chinese invasion forces, especially in that initial period of war. If they have these, then the odds of defeating a Chinese invasion or deterring it go up very significantly. And I'll footstomp, I think, Mike's point that, yes, they need the capabilities. They also need the things that come with it, the training, the organizational changes, the stuff that allows you to take that kit and put it to good effect. So by late 2021, it was clear that we needed to arm Taiwan as quickly as possible with those asymmetric defense capabilities, including the hardware and the software, if you will. It was also clear that U.S. security assistance could play a really important role in getting these weapons to Taiwan and the other kinds of support for the weapons. You're talking about, you know, direct from U.S. inventories or new production and the other kind of support, you know, basically using existing U.S. forces and capabilities to help train and do other things. We also looked at this and realized that we could use security systems to help strengthen incentives for Taiwan to make some of the hard choices that, you know, we've been talking about today, including, frankly, by empowering allies, proponents of an asymmetric defense strategy within the Taiwanese bureaucracy. Unfortunately, at this particular time, the Biden administration wasn't really paying attention. This, if you'll recall, this is when we had already begun to see Russian mobilizations around Ukraine, and that was really where administration principals' attention was. There were advocates for this kind of approach, this kind of strategy for Taiwan in the administration, but they were not fully empowered at that time. Really, Europe was on the administration's mind, and so it fell to Congress to get the ball rolling on security assistance for Taiwan. So in November 2021, Senator Hawley introduced the first bill. It was called the Armed Taiwan Act, you know, intuitively, to use U.S. security assistance to accelerate Taiwan's deployment of asymmetric defense capabilities. With Senator Gillibrand as a co-sponsor and Representative Mike Gallagher leading the House companion, this would become the first bipartisan and bicameral legislation to try to do that. Shortly after Senator Hawley dropped his bill, Senator Risch introduced his own. Senator Menendez introduced his own attempt at this later in 2022. And then, as Eric mentioned, in December 2022, Congress passed the Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act as part of that year's National Defense Authorization Act. Now, from my perspective, this was a really, really, really interesting time, both as a, just as like a nerd from like a learning perspective and also from a policy perspective, because negotiations over these bills, there's this, you know, idea in the literature that Mike will, I'm sure, correct me on if I get it wrong, but or hopefully validate if I don't, but this idea of revealed preferences, right? You can kind of see where folks are on certain issues as you put them in positions where they make certain choices. And over the course of these negotiations, both the administration and congressional leaders they were forced to take positions on key aspects of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. I would say most notably, and this is, you know, referencing, Mike talked about conditions on his last slide. One of the things that stood out, and I think is particularly notable for this conversation, was that it was very clear that both the administration and congressional leaders were extremely reluctant to put conditions on U.S. security assistance to Taiwan. As a point of comparison, Senator Hawley's bill included conditions not just, you know, to provide for accountability, ensure U.S. funds are put to good use, but also to strengthen, again, to strengthen incentives for Taiwan to fully and swiftly implement an asymmetric defense strategy with all the costly decisions that that entails. It's not easy. It is costly, but it also has to be done. So, for example, the bill specifically defined what qualified as an asymmetric defense capability so that, you know, we could prevent USAID from going to, you know, things like F-16s, just because Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense said that that's suddenly asymmetric, just as an example. The bill also conditioned U.S. security assistance for Taiwan on Taiwan matching U.S. investments in its asymmetric defenses as an attempt to hedge against the possibility that, you know, Taiwan might just, you know, take U.S. funds and basically shift their own resources towards conventional capabilities, again, not terribly useful. Along similar lines, the Armed Taiwan Act conditioned U.S. security assistance on Taiwan raising its defense spending to at least 3% of GDP, which, you know, has consistently been an ask from the U.S. government. I think there's very credible arguments even that is quite low relative to the threat. But again, the idea was to create incentives, to provide carrots to try and help Taipei get there, in large part by saying, you know, if you demonstrate progress, you unlock all this extra money as well. At the same time, the bill, thinking about something that Eric mentioned, endorsed co-development and co-production of weapons wherever possible, but it also conditioned U.S. security assistance for Taiwan on Taiwan itself acquiring those asymmetric defense capabilities as quickly as possible, regardless of the source. You know, we hit a lot of, you know, opposition might be too strong of a word, but there were concerns in Taipei that, you know, they wanted to invest in the defense industry at home. They wanted to produce a lot of these weapons at home, which is understandable, but those weapons aren't going to be available until after China might realistically invade. Well, that's not terribly helpful for them or, frankly, for us. Finally, Senator Hawley's bill linked future U.S. conventional arms sales to Taiwan to Taiwan's progress fielding asymmetric defenses. This was a response to folks in Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense who wanted conventional weapons, as we've already talked about, and were actively obstructing Taiwan's shift towards an asymmetric defense strategy. The linkage was designed to align incentives, to empower proponents of an asymmetric defense strategy in Taiwan's government and convince those MND stakeholders that the best way, in fact, the only way for them to keep getting the conventional weapons they wanted was to help or at least not hurt Taiwan's adoption of an asymmetric defense. Now, none of the bills I mentioned had conditions quite like those in the Armed Taiwan Act. In the end, there were conditions in the Taiwan Enhanced Resilience Act, largely, I should note, because legislators recognized that here in the United States, it'd be very tough politically to pass large amounts of aid for Taiwan with no conditions at all. But even those conditions were limited. The bill, speaking about terror, did not restrict which weapons Taiwan could use U.S. aid toward where could place those investments or focus them. It didn't require any sort of matching investments. It didn't link conventional arms sales with Taiwan's progress on asymmetric defenses. Instead, the most restrictive condition in TERA was simply to require the U.S. Secretary of State to certify that Taiwan had increased its defense spending relative to the year prior by no particular amount towards no particular goal. And it also allowed the Secretary to waive that requirement altogether if they determined it was in America's national interest to do so. Broadly defined, completely up to the State Department to come to that conclusion. Now, legislation is typically a result of compromise, and there are many reasons why TERA did not have stronger conditions, but underneath it all, there was a consistent feeling among many of the U.S. officials involved that this just isn't how you treat a U.S. ally or partner, especially not a fellow democracy. You might expect that that never quite made sense to me. Taiwan is a democracy, and so it absolutely gets to make its own decisions, but in my view, we are also a democracy, so we get to make our decisions too. Right, you know, in terms including, you know, whether we provide security assistance, and if we do, under what, if any, conditions. You know, Mike has also written, I think very helpfully, and pointed out that the U.S. has historically used conditions on arms sales for allies and partners in an attempt, again, to try and align incentives and shape conditions in a manner consistent with U.S. interests. So there's adequate historical precedent for this, too, and especially now, given the situation in the Indo-Pacific, we are... It is hard to imagine a more urgent situation than what we're in now, and we should, I think, be prepared to use the tools available to try and strengthen deterrence as quickly as possible. Now, that all unfolded over the course of 2021 and 2022. Where are we today? So the good news is that we did authorize aid for Taiwan under TERA. Taiwan has also taken some steps. I think Eric spoke to some of that, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. And unfortunately, neither the administration nor Congress here in the United States are really prioritizing that. One major reason is the war in Ukraine. I mentioned earlier how the war made it very difficult to get the administration to think seriously about U.S. security assistance for Taiwan for much of 2022. If I recall correctly, it wasn't until, and credit where it's due, it wasn't until the Senate Foreign Relations Committee scheduled a markup for their bill on security assistance for Taiwan, basically forcing the administration's hand, that the administration started to play ball, given these other things that were going on. Even after TERA passed, though, it's been an uphill battle. From a funding perspective, from an aid perspective, the administration has asked for and Congress has authorized more than $100 billion in aid for Ukraine. Only the last supplemental request did it include anything for Taiwan, and it was a pittance. Mike Gallagher looked at it, and he said, and this is a quote, "In a supplemental where there seemed to be money for almost everything under the sun, when it came to the most important thing, which is deterrence and American presence in the Indo-Pacific region, our priority theater, it was a joke." And he's completely right. The Senate's version of the supplemental, which passed just a couple weeks ago, fixed some of that. But even then, Taiwan was still an afterthought. You know, for example, the bill, it did have $1.5 billion for presidential drawdown authority for Taiwan, which you used to send weapons to Taiwan direct from U.S. stockpiles. That's important. It is a step forward. It is also a very small fraction of what we've provided to Ukraine. It's in many cases going to be used to try to send weapons to Taiwan that are now the stockpiles for which are at dangerously low levels by virtue of what we've already sent abroad. And critically, the bill doesn't do anything to prevent the administration from continuing to send weapons to Ukraine at Taiwan's expense. In my view, that's a critical omission because the administration has consistently done exactly that, sending weapons to Ukraine that Taiwan also badly needs, including things like Patriots, NASAMS, which are both air and missile defense systems, Stingers, HIMARS, ATACMS, GMLRS, 155 rounds, different variety of long-range fires and artillery capabilities, Javelins, UAVs, and other systems. I've written about this. RAND has published analysis sort of detailing Taiwanese requirements. You can compare that to lists, public lists of what the State Department says we have sent to Ukraine. Now, I believe strongly the United States has an interest in Ukraine defending itself, but there's no denying that these trade-offs exist, and we have to deal with them. But with rare exceptions, that hasn't been the case. Neither the administration nor Congress have done that, whether because, especially early in the war, they didn't recognize the scale of those trade-offs, or, up until the counteroffensive faltered last year in Ukraine, many folks still thought we could win in Ukraine quickly and then pivot. And some folks just truly believe Europe is more important, and there are reasons for that kind of baked into, who predominates in the U.S. foreign policy establishment today. I will also say, though, Taiwan's rhetoric hasn't helped on this. Every time Taiwanese officials praise the administration's approach to aiding Ukraine, those who want to prioritize Ukraine at Taiwan's expense come to us and say, well, see, Taiwan agrees. Fortunately, we haven't seen anything like these levels of trade-offs between U.S. aid to Israel and Taiwan's defense requirements. Now, some analysts, including at Cato, I believe, argue that that might change in the event of an expanded war with Hezbollah or with Iran, in which case, obviously, you'd expect Israel to need more of certain things. At this time, both of those scenarios seem unlikely. If that changes, you know, that's something we're going to have to grapple with and figure out, you know, how do we help ensure that, that Israel has what it needs to defend itself while preserving our ability to deter China, especially, you know, by arming the Taiwanese. I would say that even then, though, you'd expect trade-offs between Israel and Taiwan to be less than those between Ukraine and Taiwan, mostly by virtue of the fact that Ukraine's and Taiwan's requirements overlap much more clearly and expansively, and just the scale of the conflict they're witnessing now, industrial-scale conflict in Ukraine, and frankly would likely see something similar in a Taiwan context. Wrapping up, you know, that's the state of play. The supplemental I've been mentioning is it's now with the House of Representatives, and we'll see what happens. But I think, you know, the theme here, what we should be taking away here, both here in the States and in Taipei, is that neither the administration nor Congress have been prioritizing arming Taiwan, and that's a problem. In my view, no country poses a greater threat to American interests than China. I think what we have a strong, very, very strong, compelling interest in denying China's imperial ambitions, and today that requires us most urgently to strengthen deterrence against a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. If we do that, if we prioritize that, we can make war less likely, and we can also position ourselves to reliably prevail, at least have the option to do so, if deterrence fails. But to get there, we cannot, in my view, keep repeating the mistakes of just the last few years since Senator Hawley first dropped that bill. If we're going to deter China, we have to prioritize doing so, especially arming Taiwan as quickly as possible and using the tools available to us both to create incentives for Taiwan's leaders to make those hard choices and then to support them as they do that. I think we can do this, and I think, you know, if we do, there's every reason to expect that Taiwan will survive the decade and continue to flourish. If we do not, which is what trends currently suggest, then I think there's very good reason to expect war over Taiwan in this decade, and I don't know how that ends. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Alex. Mike. So my job here is to create fighting, so I'll do my best. So I wanted to push, before I throw it open to the audience, both online and in person, two different sort of themes that cropped up in different ways during the discussion. as somebody who had a really dour, pessimistic, and grim view of Taiwan, the sort of the zeitgeist in Taiwan, the public attitude, the state of play, you made me even more grim and more dour, Mike, about the kind of mentality about it. And I always ask this question, can we want it more than they want it, right? I'm left with this question that, you know, Taiwan has now squeaked up to 2.5% of GDP on defense, and that doesn't look likely to, you know, double in the policy-relevant future. So we have this, you know, small pie that we're dividing different ways among different platforms. And then we have, and maybe, you know, some of the more expert people on Taiwan itself can talk a little bit about this. The Minister of Defense saying in the last couple weeks, we're not going to engage in an arms race with China because we just, they're so big and scary and powerful. Maybe we could do some training better. And you're sort of left thinking, geez Louise, you know, that's the Minister of Defense. Is there, like, without a broad sense that the threat is real, it's close, and it matters to the way we live and want to continue living, is there a risk that we're going to shove a bunch of material onto an island with nobody to use it, right? The degradation of the Taiwan military, on and on and on. And I think if we, you know, combine the sort of blasé attitude in Taiwan with the real mania in the United States surrounding the Davidson window, right, that clock is ticking really fast. This is a grimmer picture than I ever thought. So if anybody wants to grab the incentives question, and one thing I would add in there is this question about conventional military capabilities, F-16s, large surface vessels, et cetera, one argument you hear is that, allowing China to just, you know, zip into the ADIZ whenever it wants and do whatever it wants militarily has a real deleterious effect in morale on Taiwan. We've got to show that we can at least, and these people don't even argue that like the F-16s and surface vessels are survivable or going to win or anything, but there's this weird psychological argument that's sort of floating around out there. So that's maybe the more tangible part of the question, but the broader part of the question is what the heck is going on with Taiwan psychologically? And then the second point that Alex brought up in some detail there is this question about trade-offs, right? We've had enduring questions and debates about Ukraine-Taiwan trade-offs, about Israel-Taiwan trade-offs. And, you know, I think in a sense they've been interesting, but, you know, Eric's running a blog post series about who's at the front of the line for weapons transfers has been a real eye-opener, right? The pacing threat, all the talking points that we're all used to hearing. Does the way that the United States is allocating arms transfers, both FMS and other vehicles, look like China is the priority for the United States?
Yeah, so to try and get at both, a big part of this is how manifest is the threat over what time period? And I think, Justin, when you called the Davidson window mania, I think you're right there because
mania surrounding the Davidson window. That's, I don't want to cast aspersions.
Well, that far. I mean, but I think this is really important, right? Because if you agree with Davidson that 2027 is sort of like the big number, then yes, you don't have much time. But if you think that that's too short, right, then you might have more to play with. I kind of am on the side of I think the threat is real, but over a longer period. And what I worry about, and what I try to address in the piece too, is that there is a tension also in what we do to help Taiwan and like keeping the sort of political cross-strait status quo sustainable. So what I worry about is a situation in which we buy into the, you know, very near-term problem idea, and that justifies a lot of American policy with a sense of urgency. Now, we haven't really seen that yet, but if it does generate a lot of policy with a sense of urgency, then it's like Taiwan doesn't have the time to get itself ready enough. And it puts a lot of burden on the United States, and it also, I think, opens the door to certain symbolic policy action that makes a crisis more likely in the short term, not less likely. Mm-hmm. And so I think it would, and I also think the Davidson window idea kind of undercounts problems in the PLA about their training, their readiness. Like they're in a better spot than Taiwan in the sense that they actually know what their problems are and they're working to fix them in a serious way. But they're still like they don't have much confidence. Right. If you like scratch the surface of the PLA, they don't have a lot of confidence even by 2027 that they could go toe to toe with us and win. And so I think that while I agree with like the need to prioritize Taiwan, and I worry about, you know, like we should do it, I'm okay with doing it more slowly and more incrementally, because I think we're dealing with a longer time period, and by not moving too fast, we can avoid the kind of stoking a potential overreaction from China.
Alex, do you want to transition us down this way?
Sure. I think your goal is to provoke disagreement.
Fight.
So
please.
Well done, sir.
There you go.
With tremendous respect and appreciation, I think I'm in a different place on a couple things. I mean, I think, you know, in my view, we're in a position now, or we'll soon be in a position where it's entirely plausible the Chinese leadership could look at the cross-strait military balance, come to the conclusion that there's a good enough likelihood that they will be able to succeed. And also that waiting will only hurt their chances, right? By virtue of the fact that the U.S. and Taiwan are both doing things slowly. But at some point, those things will tell, right? Eric mentioned force design 2030 for the Marine Corps. Air Force is doing stuff. The Navy at some point will, you know, get itself together. Under, you know, our submarine force obviously being much better than certain other aspects. But like there are things happening. You know, China's relative advantage is increasing. At some point, that will plateau. and then diminish. Where that knee in the curve occurs is hard to tell. It will largely be dependent on kind of Beijing's own assessment, the data it's collecting, right? So, you know, there is uncertainty, but based on what we can say, even publicly, there's perfectly good reason to believe that that could happen really at any time in the next several windows, not even necessarily waiting to 2027, especially if, for example, Beijing is looking at, for example, DoD has talked about this replicator initiative. We're going to field thousands of drones in all the domains and, you know, then kill a bunch of Chinese ships, et cetera, right? Like, if Beijing's looking at that, comes to the conclusion that, oh my, DoD might actually be able to pull it off in 2026 and it'll have a decisive impact on the cross-strait military balance, and also it is absolutely vital for my Xi's legacy and for other reasons to get this done, well, then you would expect incentives and pressure to go increase dramatically on Xi to do this thing sooner, right? So we are in a window today, I believe, where there is very good reason to believe Beijing itself might come to the conclusion that it can do it, and that waiting will actually hurt its chances over time. Therefore, war becomes more likely, and we're sort of in a very dangerous position. My view, given that context, is that we should prioritize, right? China's greatest threat, Indo-Pacific is the most important region in the world outside of North America from American interest perspective. Taiwan really is the focal point of this competition today from military perspective. Talk more about why that is my view. If that, and it's incidentally also the administration's stated view, the last administration's as well, and there's a general consensus, you know, in the foreign policy community that these things are true, right? Where it becomes more difficult is, well, how do you act accordingly while managing trade-offs in other theaters? This comes to the question of prioritizing. I don't think there's such a thing as, well, prioritize them, but slowly later after everything else, right? Like, that to me doesn't really make sense. I think if you're going to prioritize Taiwan consistent with America's interests in the context I just described, that means you front-load Taiwan for the things that Taiwan needs consistent with American interests to get ready for that scenario. That's the weapons. That's all the training and other stuff that Mike was talking about. And, you know, I think it is an extremely valid question, Justin, that you asked, right? Can we care about this more than Taiwan cares about it? The short answer is that that's very hard, right, on a number of levels. I will say, you know, this is not, in my view, my personal view, none of this is an act of charity, right? Taiwan matters to the extent that Taiwan's future is linked to America's interests in the context of this broader China problem that we face. So, you know, this is not about, oh, we're going to help Taiwan for its own sake, you know, et cetera. No, it is in America's interest to deter China in some ways, you know, almost regardless of what Taiwan wants to do. But Taiwan's decisions matter, because the fact is, if Taiwan does not get this right, then even if we do want to defend Taiwan, we may not be able to. Taiwan may be truly indefensible in a matter of years if Taiwan doesn't make certain improvements. There's also the political aspect here, right? You know, it is... Americans are skeptical of foreign wars. That's not news to anybody, right? And frankly, there's good reason for it, right? So if you're Taiwan and you're betting or would like American support, you know, it's really important there too that Taiwan steps up and does its part. We should help them to that effect. And again, Eric has mentioned this. Mike's talked a little about this. We are seeing progress. It's just in key areas, not fast enough. Our goal should be to sort of flood the box, if you will, and push it as fast as we can on multiple axes. It won't be the most efficient process, it won't be the cleanest process, but you have to accept some of that in exchange, I think, for strength and deterrence as quickly as possible in this dangerous time.
Mike, are we all wasting our time here?
Well, first, I just have to say I can appreciate your need to have a pitched battle, but I'm not going to take the bait, and I'm going to try to square the circle here by saying I don't know when the threat will be most manifest. I don't have access to that intelligence, which basically means I can't read Xi's mind. What I can say is I think that the threat is sufficiently urgent, and I agree wholeheartedly. This is not a here-and-now problem. This is a generational or perhaps multi-generational struggle. We need to buckle ourselves in. There will not be a moment, I think, where we flip the switch 1991 style and can just say, hurrah, we have won. So buckling for that struggle. The reason I would agree that this is a now problem in terms of how we have to respond politically and policy-wise is because as somebody who studies military change, organizational change, and social change, none of that happens. You know, a blink of the eye for organizational change is measured in years or probably decades. So if we're serious about this change, we got to do the full court press, flood the box now. Should we, though, to this, you know, I apologize for making you potentially even more skeptical than you were, but I am glad that I did.
Yeah.
Not because I don't think Taiwan's important, not because I'm coming here to say we should abandon all hope, like hope should spring eternal. What I am saying, though, is in order to get from here to where we need to be cognizant of the problem. And so I think we do need to shake ourselves out of the sense of complacency that don't worry, this problem will resolve itself, because it won't on its current trajectory. And I agree, we can't want this more than the Taiwanese. I lay the responsibility 100% at the feet of the Taiwanese political leadership. Social change is bottom up, but it starts at the top. And I don't think what we are perceiving as large-scale apathy is baked in. I don't think it's inevitable. I think it's a choice. It's a choice by political leadership not to stir things up by saying, listen, we have a real problem here, and if we care about the problem, it's going to take every single person pitching in for the solution in the form of much higher tax dollars, in the form of much less social welfare spending, and in the form of real defense.
And if I may, Mike, I think Ukraine helped with that a bit in terms of the Ukraine war starts in 2022. It does create some political momentum to do things like the December 22 changes to conscription and the reserve force construct. It's not enough, but it's like I don't know, a little bit of like electricity into the.
So this pitch battle, I will accept.
Body. Okay.
finally, you're fighting.
Again, we're quibbling here on the margins, but I would suggest that as much as the Ukraine war helped, I think it actually hurt more. Mm. And it hurt more in all the ways that Alex very helpfully talked about in terms of the trade-offs we face. But I think it really hurt because Ukraine shocked us all by the people's willingness to resist and the efficacy of that resistance. And because, like I said, we have a bad habit of treating unlike cases as being like cases. We wanted to hear the story that Taiwan was Ukraine. There's a great foreign policy piece by a reporter, and I agree 110%. I forget the article, but I'm happy to send it later, where she said, right now the media narrative in Western media coming out of Taiwan is what the West wants to hear, which is that the Taiwanese people are training day and night in the parks, and they are really attuned to the threat. I've been to those parks, and people are doing yoga and tai chi every morning like they always were. They weren't. I think some of these territorial defense outfits have trained maybe 8,000 or so people in a couple of years since Ukraine. It's not big enough. It's not enough of an urgency. And so I think the problem is we are seeing what we want to see in Ukraine. We are then transporting that over to Taiwan, and that's causing us to take our foot off the gas, when actually my read of the situation is Ukraine is very much not like Taiwan, and we need to double down.
Oh, this is all great. You've heard enough from us. I just want to say I'm very flattered by the people who are asking questions online in Mandarin, but I have to apologize. I can't do that. So I even see my own name in here and then a bunch of Mandarin characters, and I'm like, I hope that's nice. Let me throw it to the in-person audience first. So please wait for the microphone, which will come at some point. Please identify yourself and any affiliation you may have to whom you're directing the question, and make it a tight, nice, punchy question, and we'll fight some more up here. There's someone right here on the aisle, right here.
Hi, Jeff Giese from the Boyd Institute. Great discussion, thank you. As we're red teaming these scenarios, I have two quick questions. One, is it feasible that using asymmetric offensive capabilities, China could coerce Taiwan to unification talks without an amphibious landing? Invasion, what would that look like? Optimizing speed over mass. And then secondarily, I mean, it seems like US political decision-making is a real point of vulnerability here. To what extent are we actually prepared for attacks to freeze, jam, distract US political will to defend Taiwan?
I can start with the first thing, because I do address it a bit in the paper. So I kind of make the argument that the focus should be on the counter-invasion for Taiwan, because the things that fall short of it, if they occur in a vacuum, if they occur sort of by themselves, I don't think a sort of strategic bombing campaign or a blockade will work to achieve China's ultimate political objective of unification. Historically, those things by themselves tend not to do that. I also think that China faces a dilemma here where if they're in for a penny, they're in for a pound, in the sense that if China does do a blockade or coercive bombing, that's still war, right? Like, those are still acts of war. If they do those things without also striking a bunch of American forward deployed forces, then the likelihood of those forces increasing or being in a more serious place to thwart China's objectives goes up, right? So it's kind of like this trade-off between if they go fast and hard enough, then they sort of have the best chance of winning quickly. But in order to do that, they can't kind of do this slow escalation or build, right? And also, if you do these sort of things short of that, it opens the door to a lot of political decisions that I think, you know, are now stuff that's currently off the table because you don't have a conflict, now all of a sudden become real, right? Does Japan, for example, allow for much more bigger U.S. forward presence or even a forward deployed nuclear presence, for example, because now there's a low-level war in Asia? Does Taiwan say, okay, the old status quo is dead, I'm going to declare independence because there's war on my doorstep anyway, right? And that also is against Chinese objectives. So for those reasons, I think it's now, could they? Absolutely. And I think that Taiwan's conventional or traditional capabilities that they already have are sufficient for dealing with that sort of low-level stuff. The problem that Taiwan has is they're really not prepared for the high-level stuff. And so my focus is on if they get ready for high-level, that's also better because part of the things that make those limited uses of force so effective is the threat of going higher, right? Like, you better concede now or else life is going to get worse from you. If Taiwan can say, hey, if you go as high as you can, I'm still going to make this painful for you, it takes away some of that power of the lower level stuff. Mm-hmm. So I hope that, I think from like the political perspective, from the military perspective, the equipment perspective, I just think that yes, those are problems. They shouldn't be ignored, but it's better use of Taiwan's time going forward to prioritize specialization and not flexibility.
Anybody else want in on sketchy U.S. decision-making processes or piece that Eric took?
Touch on that.
I will maybe just say, having just spent my last remarks disagreeing with Eric, this time I'd like to emphatically agree with everything Eric said and just make the point as well that, and I've said this to folks, you know, coming over from Taipei as well, like, look, if you're not ready for the invasion, nothing else matters, right? Because at that point, the incentives are such for many, if not all, the reasons I just described for Beijing to go big, right? And that's, incidentally, Bill Burns, CIA director, talked about how that's one of the takeaways we could expect Beijing to have come to from Russia's, you know, lackluster start to the war in Ukraine, right? If you're not ready for the invasion, Beijing has incentives to go big, and then you have a very serious problem because you weren't ready for the invasion, right? So if you get ready for that, then there's a lot of lesser includeds. And you're also in a more position to manage manage escalation along the lines that Eric described. Just finally on the political piece, you know, it's really hard to say what this would look like in practice. You know, there's been some conversation on the Hill about like, you know, preemptive, like, you know, if there's a conflict, you know, what does this look like? You know, what's Congress's role? What's the president's role? Especially given some of the time factors, right? You know, if you bet you've got limited time between operational warning and bang, you know, like. Well, what does that look like, you know, for the administration to tee up options for Congress to even debate an AUMF? You know, like, can that happen fast enough for us to position things as we would need to, for example, to deter or avoid some of the preemption stuff, right? Like, it gets – bottom line, it's really hard to tell. It's something that folks should be thinking about. But underneath it all, there's this, I think, the more fundamental question too, which is where's the will of the people, right? Where are those representatives and senators likely to vote or cast their lot or stay quiet on to let the president do his part, right? You know, that's the essence really of this political piece. And there, you know, there's definitely, you know, I think there's a lot on folks who think the United States should be very involved in this in the United States to sort of say that and make that case, especially to a public that's weary of war. But again, a lot of this is ultimately going to fall on, you know, our Taiwanese friends themselves. You know, the more that Taiwan is doing evidently to defend itself, you know, that especially at the societal level, like Mike was talking about, right? You know, the easier it becomes to make the case to Americans, similar as, you know, folks have made the case to Americans on Ukraine, especially earlier in the war, that this is a fight worth supporting. And, you know, I've said this to Taiwanese officials as well, like, you know, it is going to be a hard enough question to answer why Americans should send their sons and daughters to fight and die over Taiwan, even if Taiwan is evidently willing to defend itself. Now, I ask that question when Taiwan is evidently not willing to defend itself. I mean, that just becomes orders of magnitude more difficult.
Let me bring in Ethan Kessler, who asks a question online that you guys will probably, if you're smart, try to dodge. And that's why I'm asking it. What are your expectations for the incoming Lai administration on defense reform? It seems that Lai will maintain many of the Tsai administration's defense personnel, which may mean Taipei remains reluctant to fully embrace asymmetric reform or substantially increase defense spending from 2024 to 2028. So, guys, who wants that one?
Mike?
I'll jump on the holy hand grenade because I'm not hiding any of my preferences here. Ethan, if you're online, great to hear from you. It's a terrific question. My expectations are low. I think exactly as Ethan suggested that we should expect, chances are the Lai administration will maintain the course the Tsai administration has set, and I've been very clear. I think the Tsai administration's course of action thus far has been deeply insufficient to the task at hand. So what would I like to see? And I admit that Lai will face some political difficulties, especially in this realm of assurance across the strait, because the more he is trying to raise the alarm and to push for change and to get the Taiwanese people galvanized, the more Beijing will quickly make hay of this, saying, look, you're the one who's up. But nobody forced him into the job. That's what the paycheck's for.
I think the divided legislative yuan is also going to be interesting. I don't know how that will shake out. So basically, after the most recent elections in Taiwan at the start of this year, the legislature, the DPP won the presidency but does not have a majority in the legislature. The KMT only has like a couple more seats than them. And then there's a new third party called the TPP that's sort of the swing vote, right? I'll admit I don't know enough about the TPP to know where their preferences are, but at the bare minimum, the legislative situation in Taiwan is going to make, you know, the passing of things like defense budgets trickier. So even if the Lai administration kind of wants to continue the sort of two-step forward, one-step back, halting approach to asymmetry, maybe, like, the legislative process makes that also harder. So, hooray.
Let's go back to the in-person audience here. Let's take two. Let's take in front and back there. Maybe in front first and then back, and then we'll speed this up.
Hi, I'm –
I think it'll kick on its own.
Sorry. Hi. I'm Bill Mower. I'm running for Congress across the river in Virginia's 8th Congressional District. And it seems to me what I heard from you is that the focus of the Taiwanese army is pageantry, and what we need to do is convince them that they've got to be more than pageant ready. And it seems like the challenge is that what they're doing is they're wearing a hospital gown, which gives the appearance of privacy, but everyone knows your rear end is hanging out in the back. And I think how would you communicate this situation to them in a way that will motivate them to say, we can't guarantee we're being here, that we will be here for you. And I know that has been your expectation for decades, but it's time to man up.
Great. And let's take the one there in the back at the same time.
Hi, Jonathan Mann. The Merrick, sorry, the echo. Eric had mentioned some war games he has participated in, and I've read about a series of war games with about Taiwan and U.S. defending. And we lose a lot. And if we marginally win, we lose lots of big aircraft carriers and other big ships and all that. I'm just wondering if there are additional war games that have been played, you know, or that you're aware of from the Chinese side or from the Taiwan side that you know, has any different outcomes.
So how do we get through to the MOD? And war games, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
I can start on the war game piece. So yes, the couple I've been involved in, basically, yeah, had the same conclusions, right? Of this is a very high intensity, very grinding conflict that sees relatively equivalent losses on the Chinese and American sides. So part of the reason why I think my preference is to not get involved in that conflict is because I think there's a high risk of it being a Pyrrhic victory, even if we come through okay, that, like, hooray, we did it, but unless you also sort of systematically dismantle the Chinese, like, industrial economy, which is hard to do unless you use a nuclear weapon, which I don't want to happen, like, their capacity to kind of bounce back from this might actually be higher than ours. So I think on the Chinese side, their war games, I know that I cited at length in my paper, and I really highly recommend it, the RAND Corporation did a study last year on how China assesses its own progress towards the defense reforms that Xi Jinping laid out back in, like, 2015, 2016. And the basic takeaway from that was there has been progress, but in the process of kind of improving themselves, the Chinese have also discovered, hey, there's still a lot of things that, like, are very hard for us to do, and they don't think it's necessarily going to be, they understand that this is going to probably be very costly. I don't get the sense from my read of the PLA that they think a successful fait accompli, a sort of rapid victory that keeps the U.S. out, is going to be how it plays out. When they talk about the need for the mobilization of both the military but also society for protracted conflict, that's kind of their entry point, which I think is good news, right? So this gets back to the argument we were having earlier about what is the time frame along which this happens. If the PLA is saying that about themselves, right? Yes, if Xi Jinping tells them to go tomorrow, they'll go. They'll listen to him. But I don't get the sense that the PLA is coming to Xi Jinping and saying, we have a lot of confidence that we can do this in the near term. when you look at the PLA development goals, I don't think Xi Jinping anticipated that being the case anyway from the beginning. And so... that's why I am kind of more sanguine about the timelines we have to work with. And it's not to say we shouldn't prioritize. I think we should prioritize. But I think the speed and scale of that prioritization can match what the Chinese think about themselves. As for the MND, good luck.
Do you want to take the M&D piece? I mean, the hoary old perennial was I'm mixing metaphors there. Hardy perennial was that it was, you know, part of it was KMT lineage, right? That this was not, you know, the DPP sort of came and had a different vision, but the KMT still ran the M&D, and so it didn't go along. Is that still part of the issue, or?
Well, certainly, I think in a top-heavy organization where the general officers have been around a very long time, there's definitely going to be that legacy. That is a challenge. I think part of the KMT sales pitch when it was making the rounds in D.C. was, don't worry, we can manage M&D, but if you really push them, they didn't hear any answers that the DPP hadn't already tried. I guess I would offer two thoughts. Number one, I'd like a little bit of proof of concept here. I think if there's serious movement towards reform, we are going to see a lot of generals get fired. I don't think change happens without it. And maybe it happens in a too cute by halfway where we're just downsizing the number of ranks of general officers. That's what I mean politically costly, because you are creating an enemy. But let's be honest, many of those general officers and their families weren't going to vote DPP anyway. Second, I do think, and maybe this is where, you know, if we had more time, Eric and I could have a bit more of an argument. I take a slightly different stance on this assurance versus threats piece of it. Personally, I think strategic ambiguity has served us well, but it's time to start having that conversation. I'm not saying shifting to strategic clarity, but I think conditionality does imply some sort of an incremental quid pro quo, because asymmetry without some hope that at some point we're going to be there is just asking the Taiwanese people to commit suicide very slowly and very painfully. I don't think there's a realistic way, if the Chinese have geared themselves up for a generational fight and we don't show up, that the Ukraine model is going to work for long. That said, our president on four occasions has said very explicitly he will defend Taiwan. So kind of part of me is like, what else are you looking for right now, given that you haven't really given us the proof that you're actually moving in that direction?
Alex, do you want in on this, or I might have you teed up here in the queue?
Quick thought.
Sure.
Two quick thoughts. One, to the war games question, there are better outcomes, right? There's versions of this where you know, I'm not thinking about, you know, public analysis, public war games, right? Like, even in that space, you know, when you play this out with things like Taiwan fielding a much more credible asymmetric defense, U.S. forces, hardening and dispersing operating locations in the Western Pacific for our air forces in particular, also naval forces, building out U.S. stockpiles for a lot of these key munitions, fielding things like the Marine Corps' Force Design 2030, some of the earlier increments of that, right? There are things that we can do quickly that make a dramatic difference to both the likelihood of being able to deter or defeat a Chinese invasion and also the costs associated with it, right, at the conventional level. So there is a way here. It's really just a question of whether there's the political will to sort of pursue that with the urgency required both on our side and the Taiwan side. You know, I would just say maybe just quickly on that, you know, I think I think the civilian piece of this is absolutely key. To the degree that President Tsai was able to make any progress, it seemed in large measure because she herself has decided that was really important, so she was going to spend more of that political capital. You know, I think from our standpoint, we can help to facilitate more of that. You know, we've already talked about conditions on many of these things, but broadly, right, you know, in terms of from an educational perspective, continue to provide, you know, not just as most senior folks in the civilian side, but other folks too, you know, a better sense of what the threat looks like, you know, the timelines for it, things like that. Making it as easy as possible for them to do the right thing, and that's about, again, teeing up equipment and other things that they can take on, in a manner that creates incentives for them to do so in a timely manner, and so on. So I do, again, I think we can also definitely do better here. But as I was saying earlier, you know, we haven't quite seen that evident on the U.S. side as much as it should be.
Let me make it old home week here in the online questions. Jordan Cohen asks, hey. Does Taiwan need support from its neighbors to effectively fight an attempted Chinese invasion? So Eric's paper did the good thing about bringing Taiwan back into the Taiwan military scenario story, and Jordan's broadening the aperture still more and saying, what about its neighbors? If so, which neighbors? What does it need from them? And what is the likelihood of that support being forthcoming? Thanks, Jordan.
Yeah, so this is an area where I've been frustrated for many years about the discussion around should the U.S. defend Taiwan or not. Because on the one hand, a lot of people hang this idea of if you don't fight for it, right, if Taiwan falls, then whole U.S. Alliance system in Asia falls with it, right? And that so much American credibility and reputation and alliance stuff is hanging on this key question. And then I say, well, if that's true, then shouldn't all the other allies be in this more than they are, right? It's sort of a very frustrating position to be in where you're hearing like, this matters, this matters, this matters. And then it's like, well, okay, what are you gonna do to help us? And it's like, you know.
We don't want to choose.
And so I think that given that, I think that Japan is probably in this to an extent because.
Your voice got a little shaky there when
probably,
you said that.
U.S. forces in Japan probably come under attack.
Sure.
But, right, like if China
back
does this
yeah.
as they, to, the highest chance of success of this working is looks like China schwacking everything in Okinawa and the main islands of Japan as fast as they possibly can to keep the United States out and down, right? So if they do that, I think the Japanese are in it because they've mm-hmm. just been attacked.
Yeah.
Everyone else besides that, it's an open question, right? And the U.S. has been trying to kind of nudge the allies toward making the proclamations, but there isn't really any progress on the substantive stuff. Now, that could be interesting, right? Because Taiwan right now depends entirely on us for all of its foreign-supplied military equipment, pretty much. The Japanese have good kit. The South Koreans have some good kit here, right? Their arms industries could be a big help in terms of supplying that. They have a much more sort of capacity that isn't being, you know, stress-tested by a bunch of other foreign conflicts right now. That would be fun to see, right? In terms of, you know, getting other countries in the region to take this seriously now and help, I think would be a great thing. But I don't know how, I don't think it's particularly likely in the near term.
Anybody have a divergent view on that, or did that speak for everyone up here?
Sounds pretty unison there. All right, we got time for one more from the audience here. Does anybody want one going once, going twice?
I want to ask about the arms backlog.
All right, gentleman right there in the middle. Let's do this. Let's put this baby to bed.
Thank you very much. My name is Jean-Michel Wood. I'm from Canada. I deeply care about all the subjects we have discussed. I have no expertise whatsoever, so I learned a great deal about the asymmetrical defense and all the like. I cannot dispute any of what has been discussed. However, and there is a big however, and the latter questions reflected that. That is the political will on all the parties, the congressional and other wills, the electoral, the voters, the people. And I have to say, from my perspective, what I see when I observe, the will of defending other parts of the world, the will of even remaining within NATO and defending NATO structure is very much at the center now of the campaign. So if that is the case, and if I'm a Chinese strategist or a Russian strategist, well, that's pretty good what's going on here. They don't even know what to defend. The thing to assimilate the debate is, well, the Mexicans are really more of a threat with their drugs and their traffickers than whatever happens in the rest of the world. So in a way, I cannot dispute any of what has been said. I think it's knowledgeable. You people have thought a lot about these subjects. You know your matter. But when you address these issues from a larger perspective, the political perspective, you know, one is left with the sense that the Taiwanese issue becomes very, very distant and secondary in the general scheme of things, unfortunately. And as far as the European equation, if we are going to debate whether they pay enough to their defense as to whether we should come to their rescue if they are invaded, that is also an admission of almost of defeat to begin with. So I just wanted to make those commentaries. I don't expect you to express political views on the subject, but I thought it was important to express this from, again, a foreigner's point of view, and very deeply concerned, very much involved, the very same subjects. We have a large Ukrainian population in Canada, for instance, not to mention a Chinese presence on the West Coast, an Asian economy. Nobody spoke about an important subject, which was the economic warfare that would ensue. There would be large trade sanctions. The world economy
itself would
suffer enormously. That's all I wanted to say.
No, those are great, but you asked for a dissertation, sir. And yeah, we're out of time technically. It's great. Talk a little bit, because I think one aspect of this is there's a real elite consensus in Washington, right? We've heard pacing challenge. We saw the national defense strategy under Trump, and you know, I wouldn't go on the record and say that I heard people in and around the Biden administration's national defense strategy say we didn't see a lot of need to tinker too terribly much with the Trump principles in the national defense strategy. I didn't say that on the record, but someone might say it on the record. Is there an elite public disconnect here? Because I think the elite consensus is pretty strong on Taiwan, on China, the pacing challenge, all that kind of pablum. But like in the body politic at large, this could come as a real bolt from the blue, right? In the sense that, the Taiwan Relations Act commits us to do what? And this sort of theology, the kind of Kissingerian ambiguities involved here. Are we going to have time to unpack that all and tell the American people it's time to go to war with China?
So I think one way, that's a good question. It's a very difficult one to answer. I think if we see losses, heavy losses of American soldiers in East Asia as a result of a conflict happening, I think that rally around the flag. And I think you see that support come in very strong. But beyond that, it's very much an open question, right? I think that to the Taiwanese, I would communicate, look, you know, I know like the support that the U.S. has shown to Ukraine creates some uncomfortable trade-offs and questions about prioritization. But what it also shows is that the Ukrainians performed a lot better in the early months of that war than most of them. I mean, I remember seeing a lot of articles from that from February and March 2022 of when this turns into an inevitable guerrilla war because the Ukrainian military falls apart, then what happens? And that didn't happen. And they performed much better than expected before they got a whole bunch of American equipment. And so I think if you're selling that to the Taiwanese, it's like, look, if you want to have that sort of political support, One way to do that is to do well, right? Don't lose so fast, and it creates a lot more political room for U.S. decision-making to happen within. And as far as the, like, election goes, right, I think the Trump factor is big here. When he was in his first term as president, towards Taiwan, he's kind of responsible for a lot of that $19 billion arms backlog. Because he sells a bunch of stuff and it's just now sort of starting to get delivered. So I don't think Trump is going to be seen by Taiwan sort of as negatively as he's seen by Europeans. I do think there is more of that political consensus, even with him as the Republican nominee, of yes, like this is something that both parties kind of care about, but the disconnect with the public is a real problem.
I'm getting a progressively excruciating electric shock for having gone over the time. So I'm going to unfortunately have to cut off Alex and Mike, but I think they will join us for turkey sandwiches upstairs if they have time. And please join me. I thank you and thank them for talking here today. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you.